Hello, and welcome to this PERspectives Continuing Education Podcast, created by healthcare professionals for healthcare professionals. PER is a leader in healthcare education and offers free accredited medical education programs in a variety of accessible formats at gotoper.com. Welcome to a podcast based on paradigm shifts in presbyopia, understanding advances in topical treatment innovations. This continuing education symposium took place at the recent CECO meeting. In this podcast, we will hear from Dr. Mile Brugic, a partner in the Premier Vision Group based in Bowling Green, Ohio, and Dr. Jay Pepos, medical director at the Pepos Vision Institute in Chesterfield, Missouri. We begin with Drs. Brugic and Pepos reviewing the most common approaches for treating presbyopia and the limitations of these approaches.
Well, the most common one I think and I think most patients even think this way, is glasses. I have reduced functionality, so what do I have to do? I have to put glasses on. Now, depending on your visual needs, that may be a simple pair of reading glasses, a prescription pair of glasses, or a pair of prescription progressive edition lenses. Now, the challenge with progressive edition lenses is that in order to obtain the near vision in the glasses, oftentimes you'll see patients tip their head back at computer screens. That can actually cause neck strain. It can cause a lot of issues for those patients. So we have alternate ways to treat that, and that is with office lenses. The good news with office or computer specific lenses is that patients don't need to tip their head back, but now they have a second pair or a second medical device that they're required to keep track of. You know, other alternatives to this is, well, let's maybe, for example, instead of fitting them with glasses, let's fit them with contact lenses, and specifically multifocal contact lenses. Well, that's great for individuals that want to wear contact lenses, and it's great for individuals whose ocular surface is healthy enough to support contact lens wear and who can adjust to multifocal optics. The challenge is sometimes people don't want to put or place something on their eyes, in particular the newly or the emerging presbyope. Sometimes individuals don't have powers that are accessible in contact lenses, and sometimes there's difficulties adapting to that. So there's awesome opportunities that we have currently, but there's some limitations to those. You know, we even have advances in the surgical realm as well. And the benefits to the surgical options is that when they work, they're phenomenally well. The challenge is the individual has to be somewhat willing to accept a certain level of risk with respect to the surgery to potentially achieve the outcomes they're looking for. It's part of the reason why there was this big gap, and we now have options with pharmaceuticals to treat these individuals.
Right. Well, we have lots of ways to treat presbyopia, and most of these are compromises, right? And I always say that when it comes to, you know, the natural lens and the youthful lens, God's got a pretty good patent, because when the lens changes shape, when we're in youthful lens, it's 100% of the light is being focused near or far or in between. And all the other ways that we try to fool Mother Nature, so to speak, have compromises, right? So if you're wearing reading glasses, for example, you're just shifting the defocus. So when you're wearing readers, you put them on, and then someone walks in the room, you look up and they're out of focus. So it's a little bit different in that we're not fixing the problem. We're just rearranging the blur with readers. And with bifocals glasses, for example, or blended, you know, bifocals, you know, it's been shown that there's a higher risk of falling, you know, stairs and so forth. And, you know, older patients sometimes fall, and, you know, we see patients coming in all the time. They say, I fell, I broke my hip. So, you know, that's one thing. Monovision, again, either with contact lenses or LASIK works, but the more monovision you get, the more stereopsis you lose. And, you know, one eye is always out of focus, so you have to be good at alternately suppressing each eye. We have multifocal contact lenses. They work great for some patients, but there's, again, some degradation of contrast sensitivity anytime you're splitting light between near and far. Whether it be through contact lenses or multifocal IOLs or any of those methods, you're going to be playing the cost of, you know, there'll be some cost and contrast sensitivity. There's only so much light and it's being split. Corneal inlays are no longer really in vogue in the United States. And, you know, I think in there was, you know, near vision CK, conductive keratoplasty, but those are the main ways that presbyopia are being corrected either through surgery or non-surgical methods.
Topical miotic treatment has emerged as a new approach for treating presbyopia. It works by temporarily modulating the iris to generate a pinhole effect, extending depth of focus without affecting peripheral vision. Let's listen to Drs. Brugic and Pepos review the mechanisms of action of topical miotics for presbyopia and the features of the ideal miotic agent.
The beautiful part about, you know, what we're currently using, and really at this point, the only FDA-approved technology for treating presbyopia, is pilocarpine 1.25%, really packaged in a way that makes it usable for the patient. It neutralizes itself after leaving the bottle and being placed on the surface of the eye. So it's a cholinergic agonist. And we all know what that means. We learned it in our first year of optometry school. And essentially it activates the sphincter muscle on the iris. And in essence, it actually creates a pinhole effect. The good news about that is the mechanism isn't complex for us to understand. We see this and we demonstrate this on a daily basis with patients in our office that we're performing pinhole occlusion or pinhole acuity on. So what's interesting with it is, you know, companies have now leveraged our understanding of pinhole effect in order to deliver extended depth of focus. And in doing so, it helps some of these presbyopes perform in ways without the need for medical devices that they haven't been able to do in years. The ideal miotic, if I had my druthers and I could create something that could be perfect or best suited for a patient, it would be a single dose that would last all waking hours, that would have no influence on the distance vision and improve near visual acuity to a level where the patients would be functional again with zero risks. Those would be the characteristics of the ideal miotic that I would be searching for patients.
Well, I think the ideal miotic would have a very rapid onset of action. It would be comfortable, you know, not stinging, not blurring, have a favorable safety profile, you know, in terms of things that we hear such as brow aches or headaches. We want to maintain good night vision. In other words, we don't want to make the pupils so small that patients complain of dimming. If you make the pupil too small and you get the retinal illumination below like 100 trolins, you can start to get a decrease in neural contrast and patients complain of dimming. We certainly want to have good near efficacy and not just near, but intermediate vision improvement and long duration. The longer the duration, patients will be able to use fewer drops. And there might be some advantage to even having a tunability aspect. You know, so for example, maybe use one drop and the pupil gets to a certain size, but if you need more for a certain period of time, you might use a different, drop, like some type of combination drop. So those, I think, would be different considerations in terms of, you know, what might be an ideal miotic drop.
The FDA approved use of pilocarpine hydrochloride 1.25% ophthalmic solution for presbyopia in November 2021. The approval was based on results of the Phase 3 Gemini 1 and Gemini 2 clinical trials.
Essentially, what happened in this study were individuals that were healthy with powers between the prescriptions of +1 to -4 were recruited in the study. They had to have complete dilated eye exams, and they had to have the absence of any retinal disease. If they met those criteria, they were then randomized to either receive the active or a placebo medication. They dosed it once a day for 30 days, and they came into the clinics that were running the studies periodically. I think it was day 1, 7, 14, and 30. The clinical trial data, or that the data that they were looking at as the primary endpoint, was at 3 and 6 hours after dosing on day 30. What percentage of patients had at least a 3-line or greater improvement in visual acuity with their distance corrected near vision? What that means is, with their best distance vision, or whatever that correction was when they're wearing it, how low can they go on the near point card? And if they achieved greater than or equal to a 3-line improvement in that near acuity, based on a typical logMAR chart, they succeeded that mark. Again, there was nothing, I think, earth-shattering or shocking with this, because again, a pinhole effect increases depth of focus, and it in fact does do a good job of reducing blur circles and improving patients' functionality with the near vision. Whenever we talk about efficacy, we also need to think about safety. So the one side effect that came up at the highest level was the headaches that were reported. Now, these are headaches that were reported at any visit. They were counted as one. The way this was actually diced out were individuals in the study were actually given a visual analog scale, and they were asked on that scale from 0 to 100 to rank their headache. And if they ranked anything other than a 0, they were actually put into that headache category. I think it is important to put context around how it was measured, because I think that gives us a better idea of the reporting mechanism. What is interesting is that the large majority of them were mild or transient headaches that individuals experienced, and a lot of them actually went away too as they persisted or continued to utilize the drops as well too. There were other side effects, but they were all much lower, some temporary instillation site irritation and things like that, some temporary hyperemia, but most of those things were very low, and although they were a little bit higher than placebo, they were very close to the placebo arm.
Other meiotic agents in clinical development include CSF1 and PRX100. CSF1 is an investigational agent containing a low-dose proprietary pilocarpine 0.4%. Pooled study data found that improvement in near vision occurred in 50% of patients 1 hour after a second dose. A second investigational agent, PRX100, is formulated with the meiotic acyclidine combined with tropicamide, a common pupil dilator. In a Phase 2 study, 97% of eyes treated with PRX100 gained at least 2 lines in distance-corrected visual acuity, a significant difference relative to placebo. Doctors Brugic and Pepos reviewed these two investigational agents.
There are several other meiotics that are actually being studied. So the first is, and the one that's likely to be approved soonest, is CSF1, which is a lower dose pilocarpine and preservative free unit dose vials that has the flexibility of a BID dosing regimen. It's a lower concentration than what we currently have available, but it's packaged in a more neutral environment within the vial. So the clinical trial data is pretty impressive on this so far, and it'll be interesting if and when we do get approval to this, where this will kind of have a role in our practices. There's also other agents that are being studied. Carbachol is one, and carbachol is another meiotic agent that's a cholinergic agonist, and it's being looked at in combination with brimonidine, which is actually an alpha 2 adrenergic agonist, which prevents pupil dilation. So you have a constricting agent and you have something that's preventing pupil dilation, and it's seemingly providing greater efficacy over time or throughout the day. There's other agents that will actually inhibit the sphincter muscle and then also activate the sphincter muscle. So for example, there's a company that's now working on a 2-dosing system where you'll put a dose in the evening, phentolamine, which is a alpha adrenergic antagonist, again, preventing or inhibiting pupil dilation. And then in the morning, you'll add pilocarpine, which will actually constrict the pupil, and it'll be a lower dose pilocarpine. There's also a company that's working on a molecule referred to as aceclidine. Aceclidine is one that's not very commonly, or not a common name that we're familiar with, but it is a cholinergic agonist. And what this does is it has a high level of specificity for the constrictor muscle, or the sphincter muscle of the iris. And in doing so, it has very hyperspecific activity on just that sphincter muscle without influencing the ciliary muscle. And in doing so, it seems to have a longer time frame of activity. Combining with brimonidine even seems to add more time to its level of efficacy. So it really is an exciting time, because we're looking at agents that not only cause pupil constriction, but we're also changing the way that it interacts with the cholinergic system and the longevity of it throughout the day.
Right. So there's a number of different companies that are in the process of drug development. The one that's made it through, you know, an NDA is the one we talked about, Vuitine, which is the 1.25% pilocarpine. But Oasis is also has a low dose pilocarpine at 0.4% BID. There's a spray or mist now that's in development by Inovia. Lens has aceclidine and the combination product of aceclidine and brimonidine. Vicis has carbacol and brimonidine combination. And Ocufire Pharma has phentolamine alone and in combination with low-dose pilocarpine. So the with the exception of phentolamine, which only works on the iris dilator, inhibiting the iris dilator, all the other drugs are working on the sphincter muscle as agonists, creating some meiosis. And, you know, again, these drugs may differ, we'll have to see, in terms of each patient. I suspect that there's going to be some patients that'll be better matches for certain drugs. It may depend on their pupil size, may depend on, for example, the practitioner's assessment of their risk of retinal attachment, for example. Maybe we don't want to use a drug that can engage the ciliary muscle at all in some of those patients. It might be patients might select drugs because of they like the duration, or they some may use this just on occasion. You know, like I'm going out on a date and I don't want to wear my readers, and they won't be using it day after day. So and there may be different adverse event profiles. Some may be more prone to headache or brow ache. Some may be less. I would always never underestimate the importance of intermediate vision. And even though these clinical trials had three lines of improvement as the criteria, a lot of patients are pretty happy with two lines. It seemed to, if you look at the patient reported outcomes, there was a pretty tight anchoring with two lines. So, you know, I think that there'll be a lot to choose from, and it may not be one size fits all from patient perspective, just depending on their anatomy, the size of their pupil, pigmentation of the iris, and the adverse event profile.
Evaluating patients to determine if they're good candidates for a pharmacologic treatment for presbyopia is key to successfully using miotic therapy. Dr. Sprugic and Pepos outline their strategies for patient evaluation when considering a miotic to treat presbyopia.
Understanding how to evaluate these individuals is important. I always tell patients with presbyopia, I say, you're fortunate. We're in a time where we have essentially four options to help with your presbyopia. The first is glasses. The second is contacts. The third is surgical options. And the fourth is now there is prescription eye drops that are available to help you see better up close. And then I start to strategically characterize those treatment options that are best for that patient based on their ocular health, based on what they're looking to do and based on whether or not they want to be glasses free, because those are all clinical considerations that we need to be taking into consideration as we're strategically kind of making our recommendation. I'll oftentimes tell patients, you know, oftentimes it's not just one of these options that you'll be using. Oftentimes these treatments can be layered to provide you the best visual outcomes. And that's where we start tailoring things to make sure that we're getting as specific as we possibly can with that patient's actual individual needs.
Well, again, I think the, you know, from my perspective, the most important thing is, you know, first do no harm, you know, and so, you know, that in my mind, what am I looking for? I don't want to have a patient who's going to come in with a retinal tear or a retinal detachment. I mean, you know, and even though it might not be causally related, you know, in some of these patients it occurred within sometimes hours, sometimes days of drops. And so, you know, there's an FDA adverse event website, and, you know, there were 29 cases reported to the website with 1.25% pilocarpine. So I do think it's really important to do a fundus, you know, examination, a dilated exam, looking at the periphery. I would consider doing an OCT because, again, if there's vitreomacular adhesion, they might be at a higher risk. And also these drugs are contraindicated in patients, you know, with a history of iritis. So those would be the things that I would be looking at, you know, from a safety perspective. The second thing I would look at is, you know, we know that patients' pupils get smaller as they get older. And so, you know, if you have a patient who already has a very small pupil, they may not get as much benefit, you know, from the drug as someone that has a larger pupil. And also you want to be careful in assessing the lens. So for example, let's say a patient in their, you know, we see patients who start to get cataracts, and some of these patients get cataracts earlier than others. You know, some get cataracts in their early, in their 50s or 60s. So, you know, if they have a nuclear cataract, making the pupil small is going to make things worse. So, you know, those are kind of things that that I would look for. And I would certainly, you know, give patients warnings, like I mentioned about dimming at night, maybe not trying the drop. If they're going to try the drop, and particularly if they're going to use it twice a day, maybe the first time they use it in that afternoon, maybe wait for them to get home and see how they respond to the drop so that they're not driving at night the first time they're using the drop and have dimming and then have an issue. So I think those would be all, you know, prudent ways to, you know, to approach this. You know, giving them the idea that, you know, to look for these things and telling patients, if you have these symptoms, we want to hear you stop the drop and call right away. You know, flashes, floaters, flashes, dots, curtain falling, all the things that we would. And a lot, amazingly, a lot of these patients, particularly, I'm amazed all the time. Patient came in with LASIK. You look in the chart, they were -7, and they've never been told that they're at higher risk for retinal tears and what to look for. So this is another service that, you know, we're providing. But I think the message is, this is not something you want to prescribe for a patient who calls in and says, I heard that there's something on TV. Can I get a prescription? The answer is, we want to have you come in, maybe have a full evaluation of your ocular health, and then determine if you're a good candidate for this drop.
Thank you for your attention, and we hope that this program was informative and of benefit to your practice. Thanks for listening to this PERspectives podcast. If you like today's episode, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Amazon Music, and many of your other favorite podcast platforms. While you're there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening.